Would you pray with me? Guide us, O God, by your word and spirit, that in your light we may see light, in your truth find freedom, and in your will discover your peace. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Today we begin a series on the book of Hebrews, which I'm very excited about. And so I look forward to plumbing the depths of this rich and rewarding book with you over the coming months. Hebrews is particularly known for its countless citations and allusions to the Old Testament. And so when we start up Sunday school again in September, September 13th, the adult class will be exploring the Old Testament passages that are relevant for that day's sermon in Hebrews. So I encourage you to join us for that class when it begins in September. Now, you may scratch your head a bit when I say this sermon will begin a series on Hebrews, because I didn't read any passages from Hebrews this morning, and I will not be preaching on a passage from Hebrews today. Instead, I'll be preaching on Psalm 110, and I'm going to explain why that is in just a moment. But first, I do want to give some background for the book of Hebrews. Now, there's this persistent question when it comes to the book of Hebrews, that is, who wrote it? See, unlike other books in the New Testament, the author of Hebrews never identifies himself. And so this always has been, and it always will be, kind of an open question with Hebrews, since the Bible doesn't say. Now, while that debate is interesting to nerds like me, it's not something that I want to spend a lot of time on in these sermons, so I'm just going to kind of lay my cards out on the table for you. I believe the book of Hebrews comes to us from the Apostle Paul. And there is some evidence that that is how the earliest Christians received it as well. Now, you see, many interpreters, both ancient and modern, have questioned Pauline authorship because in the original Greek of Hebrews, the writing style is very different from Paul's other letters. But it turns out the writing style of Hebrews is very similar to the writing style of the Gospel of Luke and the book of Acts, which were both written by Paul's close companion, Luke. And the style of Hebrews is very similar to the sermons of Paul that Luke records in the book of Acts. So there's some reason to believe that Hebrews was originally some kind of sermon of Paul's, which Luke then recorded, possibly even translating from Paul's Hebrew or Aramaic, and he turned it into a document then for circulation among the churches. And then you add to this that many of the same ideas and a lot of the same Old Testament quotations and citations that we have in the book of Hebrews, we also find in the undisputed letters of Paul. So it kind of looks like the same mind is behind all these letters, though he's employing different scribes to write things down for him at different times. Now, if we get to heaven and find out that I'm wrong about some of that or about all of that, I apologize in advance, right? Okay. This is just my best guess based on what we have received. But for the sake of clarity and simplicity as we go through this book, I'm going to work from that assumption, right? That Hebrews comes from the Apostle Paul by the hand of Luke, and that we can interpret it in light of Paul's ministry as we see it in the book of Acts and in light of Paul's other letters that we have in the New Testament. Now, I said just a moment ago that I believe the reason Hebrews doesn't have some of those features that we usually find in Paul's letters, like the greeting, like saying hello to various friends, why doesn't it have some of those features, is because Hebrews reads more like a sermon. It reads more like a sermon than a letter. In Hebrews 13:22, then, we also have this. Paul refers to this book as a word of exhortation, a word of exhortation. And that exact Greek phrase is also used in Acts chapter 13, verse 15, where it refers to a sermon Paul gave in the synagogue in Pisidian Antioch. Luke says at that synagogue service, they had a reading from the Torah, from the law, and from the prophets. And then the leaders of the synagogue asked Paul to give a word of exhortation. So it seems like that phrase denotes what we would call a sermon. It's explaining and applying a passage from the scriptures to the congregation that's gathered there. In addition to that, throughout Hebrews, the author uses verbs that are related to speaking and to hearing. He doesn't use verbs related to reading and writing. So he is framing all of his words as if he's in a public speaking situation. And then on top of this, Hebrews has a lot of the same features that we see in other Jewish synagogue sermons from around this same time period. And we find that these sermons usually would center on one specific text from the Old Testament, probably one of the texts that was read for that day. And then they would take their main points from that one passage, but then they would cite and allude to all these other Old Testament passages to explain that passage. And Hebrews clearly is employing that method. And if Hebrews is following that typical synagogue sermon pattern, then it also seems that Paul's sermon text for Hebrews is Psalm 110. Hebrews contains more than 100 direct citations or allusions to the Old Testament, but the passage that it refers to the most is Psalm 110. And the major themes that we will be seeing in the book of Hebrews and that it keeps coming back to come from Psalm 110. So now you know why we're beginning a series on Hebrews with this refresher on Psalm 110. There's a method to my madness, at least in this case. So you can turn to Psalm 110 if you want to follow along. Now, not only is Psalm 110 the most quoted Old Testament passage in Hebrews, it's the most quoted Old Testament passage in the New Testament. Hebrews helps with that a little bit. But we know that this psalm was important to Jesus and the apostles because they refer to it so much. So let's see if we can figure out why that is. The first thing that we should note when we come to Psalm 10 is what we call the superscription, which is that little title before the body of the text begins. And it simply says, of David. Now, this is traditionally understood to mean this psalm was written by King David and is coming from his perspective. And that might help us to kind of sort out who the other people in Psalm 110 are, as we'll see. Because the very first verse can be a little confusing. It reads, "The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand." And here what we're seeing is kind of one of the disadvantages of a certain convention in translation. What you have to remember when you're reading through the Bible, if you have a newer translation that uses this capitalization, when you see Lord in all caps, that's the translators telling you that the Hebrew word behind that is actually God's name. God's name, which he reveals as Yahweh in Hebrew. And when you see Lord with lowercase letters, this is translating a title. The Hebrew word is Adonai, and that title means Lord or Master. Now, Adonai can be applied to God, and it often is in the scriptures, because he is Master, he is Lord. But Adonai can also be applied to human masters and lords. And that's actually what's happening here in Psalm 110, right? Now, obviously, Yahweh is not talking to himself. He's addressing this other person, and he's calling this other person Lord, right? Or David, I should say, is calling this other person Lord. David writes, "Yahweh says to my Lord." Now, who does the pronoun my refer to in that sentence? This is where that superscription comes in. This psalm is spoken by King David, right? So this Adonai, this Lord, this lowercase Lord here, is not referring to David himself, because David says this person is his Lord. And of course, David could say that Yahweh is his Lord, Yahweh is his master, but in this verse, David is clearly distinguishing between Yahweh and David's Lord, David's master, whoever he may be. And we know that this understanding is correct because in the Gospels, Jesus quotes Psalm 110 and he makes this same point, right? We heard it in our Gospel reading from earlier this morning. While the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question saying, "What do you think about the Christ?" That's the word for the Messiah, God's anointed one, the promised king. "What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he?" They said to him, "The son of David." He said to them, "How is it then that David in the Spirit calls him Lord, saying," Psalm 110, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet." Now do you see the conundrum that Jesus is putting the Pharisees in here? Because every Israelite knows that this Messiah, this Christ, this anointed one, this promised king, every Israelite knows that king has to be a descendant from the line of David. He has to be a son of David because God made a covenant with the house of David and he promised this. But then in Psalm 110, which every Israelite knew was about this Messiah, David speaks of this Messiah as his Lord. David puts himself under the authority of the Messiah. Now, ordinarily, sons are under the authority of their fathers, right? Not the other way around. But Jesus is pointing out this paradoxical implication of Psalm 110. The Messiah who is yet to come will be David's son, but the Messiah will also be David's Lord. The Messiah will have authority even over the greatest king in Israel's history, even over his own ancestor. And so Jesus continues there in Matthew, "If then David calls him Lord, how is he his son?" And no one was able to answer him a word, nor from that day did anyone dare to ask him any more questions. So we learn a couple of important things from that interaction in the Gospels. We learn that in the first century, when Jesus lived, when the apostles lived, Jews understood that Psalm 110 portrayed Yahweh speaking to the Messiah. And we learn from Psalm 110 that King David even recognized the Messiah as having authority over him. And Jesus wasn't the only one to interpret Psalm 110 to be speaking of the Messiah. The vast majority of Jews in Jesus' day also understood Psalm 110 to be prophesying this greater son from the line of David to come. And they believed that this son would come and would deliver Israel from her oppressors, that he would then be raised up as king and rule over Israel in righteousness. And they believed this Messiah would then lead all nations in right worship of the God of Israel, in right worship of Yahweh. And they believed that this would happen because it's what God promised to do for his Messiah right here in Psalm 110. Yahweh says to the Messiah, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." Now this verse where God tells the Messiah, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet," this is going to be one of the two images from Psalm 110 that will become the main point of the book of Hebrews. Okay? So that's why we're doing this. Psalm 110, verse 1, is directly quoted at the beginning of Hebrews and at the end of Hebrews. It's clearly alluded to at least two other times in Hebrews. And incidentally, verse 1 is also cited at least 10 other times in the New Testament. So it was clearly a key verse for the early church, this idea that the Messiah would be invited to sit at the right hand of God. But what is verse 1 promising? God says to the Messiah, sit at my right hand. Now in the scriptures, sitting is a posture of rule and authority. It's a posture of discerning and of judging and putting things in the right order. And that's what's being pictured here. The Messiah is being enthroned in a position of rule and authority. But where is the Messiah seated? God says, sit at my right hand. Now, of course, God is already seated and ruling over all things. God is already on his throne. And here God is inviting the Messiah to ascend the dais and to take the seat at God's right hand to rule alongside God. But where is God? Where is his right hand? Of course, God is in heaven. His throne is in the heavenly holy place. Now, ancient Israelites knew that God did not have a right hand in the same sense that we do. They knew God didn't need to sit down like we do. And they knew heaven wasn't a physical location in the same sense that Kearney, Nebraska is, right? It doesn't have a zip code. But there is this symbolic language here used to communicate that the Messiah is being called into this intimate communion and fellowship and partnership with God. He is being identified with God, sitting on the same dais as he is. He's serving as God's representative. He's serving as God's vice regent. He is the king under the direct authority of the King of Kings and ruler of all. Now, first century Jews, like the apostles, understood that God would raise his Messiah up, as it were, into the heavenly throne room and share his rule with him. And we need to realize how remarkable this idea is. Right? We're talking about a human being. This is an unbelievably high honor to bestow on a mere man. This coronation invests this human Messiah with the glory of the immortal God. I think you can agree there is no higher honor, there is no greater authority that could be bestowed on a human being. He will literally be the right-hand man to the God of the universe. And so this means that the Messiah would be raised above not just all other Israelites, but above all earthly rulers, all kings, all princes, and rulers of men. Think about it. If the Messiah takes the seat at God's right hand, wouldn't that mean he is raised above all the other beings who are part of God's heavenly council? Wouldn't that mean the Messiah is raised up above the prophets of old who served on God's council, even above the greatest prophets who had seen and spoke with God, like Moses, like Elijah? Wouldn't that also mean the Messiah is even raised above the angels and above the heavenly creatures who eternally serve God and bow before his throne and worship? Wouldn't it mean that? As we will see next week and in following weeks, that is precisely how Paul understands what is prophesied here in Psalm 110, verse 1. This wondrous promise that an actual human being who is David's son and David's Lord will ascend to the heights of heaven, will be honored above all angels and prophets, will be seated at the right hand of God. This is the wondrous event that was promised to the people of Israel in Psalm 110. So Yahweh has seated David's son and David's Lord at his right hand. What else will he do for him? Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. And then verse 2, notice the all capital letters. Yahweh sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter, the Messiah's mighty scepter. Yahweh says to the Messiah, rule in the midst of your enemies. And then skipping down to verse 5, we see more of this conquering imagery. The Lord is at your right hand. Now, which Lord are we talking about there? It's not the Hebrew name for God. It's the word Adonai. And I think it makes most sense to see this as David saying to God, the Messiah is at your right hand, God. Because that's the arrangement we already saw in verse 1, wasn't it? So the actions here in verses 5 through 7 are actions the Messiah will accomplish as God's appointed deliverer for Israel, as the one who sits at God's right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his wrath. He will execute judgment among the nations, filling them with corpses. He will shatter chiefs over the wide earth. He will drink from the brook by the way. Therefore, he will lift up his head. So Psalm 110 portrays this human being being exalted at God's right hand in order to act as God's warrior king on behalf of Israel. So that like his father David, the Messiah will go to battle against the enemy of God, the enemies of God and of God's people. The Messiah will judge the nations. He will defeat the powers and rulers who would attack and enslave and oppress God's people. And he will be victorious because God has promised it. Now remember, for an Israelite who's living in the first century AD, your people were currently subject to Rome. And before that, you'd been subject to the Syrians. And before that, the Greeks. And before that, the Babylonians. And before that, the Assyrians. And before that, the Canaanites and the Philistines and the Egyptians, right? So the idea that God would one day raise up an Israelite king to finally free his people from their enemies, that had to seem like a promise that was too good to be true. And yet God promised through David here that one day he would send such a king, that God would raise him up to the throne of heaven above all other chiefs and kings, that this Messiah would rule in the midst of his enemies, that God would make his enemies into a footstool for the Messiah, for his king. So, of course, all Israelites who trusted in this promise, they longed for this to happen. They longed to come under the rule of such a king. They longed to participate in his rule, participate in his kingdom. And God says they will. Verse 3. God says to the Messiah, your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power, or the day you lead your forces, in holy garments. From the womb of the morning, the dew of your youth will be yours. That last bit is particularly difficult to translate, but the gist of this, I think, is clear. When the Messiah takes his throne, all the faithful of Israel, they will gladly offer him their allegiance. They will follow where he leads, even if that means going into battle, even if it means enduring suffering and trials alongside their king, because they know this is God's appointed king, and all their hopes lie with him. Now, we're going to see a lot about enduring suffering and remaining faithful to the Messiah when we get into Hebrews, but we see it first here in Psalm 110. The Messiah's people offer themselves willingly on the day he goes to battle. Then we come to verse 4, which gives us the second main theme that we're going to see in the book of Hebrews. Verse 4 is directly cited at least 5 times in Hebrews, and verse 4 essentially gets 3 whole chapters of discussion in the book of Hebrews. So verse 4, again, notice it's all capitals, Lord. Yahweh has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Now this is something entirely unexpected in Psalm 110. God promises the Messiah will be a priest forever, a priest like Melchizedek. And I say it's unexpected because Melchizedek, he only appears one other time in the whole Old Testament. And that's in Genesis 14. Genesis 14 occurs early in the story of Abram, later called Abraham. And Abram's nephew, Lot, has been captured by enemies. And this prompts Abram to gather his fighting men and to pursue these enemies and to rescue Lot. And on his return from this successful battle, Abram is met by a guy named Melchizedek. And he's said to be the king of Salem, which we believe is Jerusalem, later called Jerusalem. And Genesis 14:18 tells us not only that this Melchizedek is the king of Salem, but that he is a priest. He's a priest of God Most High. And typically in the Old Testament, when you see this title, God Most High, that's used by Gentiles to refer to the true God. Right? So in this passage, Abraham himself identifies Yahweh, his God, as God Most High. So Melchizedek was a worshiper of the true God, the God of Israel. And Melchizedek brings out bread and wine for Abram and his men, and then he pronounces a blessing over Abram, and he blesses God Most High, who has delivered Abram's enemies into his hand. And Abram, in response to this, then gives Melchizedek a tithe. He gives them a tenth of the spoils from the battle as a way of paying tribute to the God whom Melchizedek serves as priest. And that's it. In the whole Old Testament, there are three verses in Genesis 14 that talk about Melchizedek. That's all we have until we get this one more verse hundreds of years later in Psalm 110. So why does David mention this otherwise obscure and mysterious character here in this psalm? I think there are a few reasons. For starters, Melchizedek's name means King of Righteousness, or My King is Righteousness. And later in Scripture, God makes it clear that a king after his own heart will be a righteous king. A king who does what is right, a king who establishes right order, a king who justifies Israel. And of course, it will be a king who reflects God's own righteousness in all that he does. So a king of righteousness sounds like God's ideal king. But what's really unique about Melchizedek is that he is both king and priest. He is both king and priest to God. You see, in Israel, God will later separate the priesthood from the kingship, right? According to God's command, only men from the tribe of Levi, who also happen to be sons of Aaron, could serve as priests to God. Now, David was from the tribe of Judah, and of course, all his sons were as well. That's how that works. Thus, even if they wanted to be, the descendants of David could never serve as priests in Israel. They could be kings, but not priests. But here in Psalm 110, verse 4, Yahweh swears this oath to the Messiah, to the son of David, "You are a priest forever," after the order of Melchizedek. In other words, God anoints the Messiah not only as king, but as a priest. God ordains the Messiah to the priesthood here in Psalm 110. But it's a different kind of priesthood than what had existed in Israel up to that point. He's not ordained to the priesthood of Levi, to the priesthood of Aaron, because he's not a Levite. He's not a son of Aaron. No, the Messiah will be a priest like Melchizedek, a priest who is also a king. A king who is also a priest. And as king, he will rescue his people from their enemies. And as priest, he will lead his people into the true worship of the true God. Now, you can probably understand why this psalm garnered so much attention and speculation from succeeding generations of Israelites. Because for one thing, during their whole history, the priesthood and the kingship had always been totally separate offices. None of the sons of David who had been kings had ever been priests as well. Add to this that by the time of the first century, when Jesus and the apostles lived, both the kingship and the priesthood in Israel had become corrupt. Their kings weren't even sons of David, and they certainly were not kings of righteousness. They were pretenders, and they were puppets of foreign empires. And the priests of Israel at that time weren't any better. They had bribed and murdered their way into office, and they devoured the sheep instead of feeding them. So you can imagine that when faithful Israelites in the first century were singing Psalm 110, that they did so with tears in their eyes and a catch in their throat. They were fervently praying that God would finally make good on the promise he had made to David. They prayed he would send this son of David who would also be David's Lord. They were praying this Messiah would ascend and sit at the right hand of God's throne as glorious king to shatter and judge the enemies who oppressed them. And they prayed that this king of righteousness would also be a priest forever, a priest after the order of Melchizedek, who would purify Israel from their sin. A faithful priest who would lead Israel in the presence of God to commune with him in righteousness. Brothers and sisters, we want the same thing, don't we? We don't often recognize it, but we are surrounded by enemies. We are oppressed by mighty powers. It's just that our oppressors are not the Assyrians or the Babylonians or the Romans. Our attacker is our own sin. Our oppressor is the devil. Our fear is the fear of death. So the feeling of guilt over mistakes we've made, the despairing thoughts that plague our minds, the worn-out muscles and aching joints that greet us new each morning, this is not the way it was meant to be. And these are the effects of our enemies, of Satan, sin, and death. So we want a mighty king to come and to shatter these powers, to come and free us from their oppression. Because these enemies have cut us off from the source of true life. We are far from our God, far from the light and life of his heavenly kingdom. And so we want a human being like us who can ascend to the Father's right hand, who can be seated at God's right hand, who will rise above all spirits and all angels and take our human nature into the intimate communion that we long to have with our Creator, the one who created us for that communion. Because we understand that we are not ourselves able to enter that heavenly throne room. We are not able to enter that heavenly holy place. We are not fit to be in the presence of a holy God because we are defiled. We are unclean. We are sick. We are dying. So we need a priest. We need a priest who can also heal our bodies, cleanse our hearts, purify our conscience, cleanse us from the inside out. We need a priest who will offer right sacrifices on our behalf, who will offer righteous prayer for our salvation, so that in him we can be made whole and finally draw near to God as we were created to do. So, people of God, the book of Hebrews shows us this Messiah that we see in Psalm 110 has come to us in Jesus. Jesus is both David's son and David's Lord. He is the promised messianic king. And Jesus, who is God in human flesh, God and man, has, as the God-man, ascended above all kings, chiefs and nations. He has ascended above all spiritual powers, even above all angels. Jesus has sat down at the right hand of God until his enemies will be made a footstool for his feet. And Jesus has also been ordained a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek, so that we might have such a high priest as Psalm 110 promised, a priest who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, as Hebrews says, so that by his ministry we can have confidence to enter the holy places, so that we can draw near to God with hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and bodies washed with pure water. And Hebrews tells us that Jesus, Messiah, has accomplished all of this so that we can hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, no matter what trials we might endure. For, Paul says, he who promised in Psalm 110 to send us such a glorious king and priest, he who promised is faithful, and he has sent us Jesus.